You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
We wild our child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hello, thanks for joining us for episode 10 of the Untaming Podcast. I received some interesting feedback about last week's episode with rape culture specialist Charlie Brooke, when we talked about how the media perpetuates inequality between the sexes. It initiated a lot of discussion amongst my own family. I hope you found yourself being as self-reflective of your behaviour as my own family has been the last few days. Next week, I have a very exciting episode lined up for you with Dr. Katrina Walsh. That one really throws our mainstream beliefs about food out the window. In today's episode, Alexa and I talk about keeping our babies nappy free. I tried keeping my daughter completely out of nappies day and night from birth, as I will mention. I gave up on nights after 10 days though. But just a couple of weeks after recording this interview, she began to cue very obviously during the night when she needed to go. So I began keeping the potty next to the bed and offering it to her whenever she just started squirming, with complete success. And after just another week or two, I stopped putting her in cloth nappies overnight to save us the hassle of putting them on and taking them off whenever we needed to. She's now 9 months and hasn't worn nappies day or night since she was 6 months old. I just wanted to share that because when we recorded this episode, I did not think nighttime potty awareness could be anywhere near as easy as it turned out to be. I record most of these interviews in the evening once my children have gone to sleep. Today's episode is the only one where my daughter woke up during it. You breastfeeding mothers will understand when I say that only I can get her back to sleep at night. So we had to interrupt this interview for 20 minutes while I rescued my husband, who was trying unsuccessfully to comfort her. I've been holding on to this episode for a few months, reluctant to edit it, because in addition to that interruption, Alexa and I got quite off topic a couple of times. This episode was initially a 2-hour recording. I hope the cut when we were interrupted isn't too distracting. The audio quality also fluctuated a bit, unfortunately. But I really like talking to Alexa. She has a very warm and poetic way of speaking that I hope you'll appreciate as much as I did. Alexa Pedersen was born in a birthing unit in Rotorua and grew up in Havelock North, New Zealand, and currently lives in a yurt on a communal farm near Nelson, New Zealand, with her partner Benji and 6-month-old Matea. Alexa supports herself by selling very sweet, well-crafted fairies that she makes out of felt at farmers markets and online. Her business is called Spooning Trees. Last night, she had 6.5 hours of sleep, and for breakfast this morning she had 2 soft-boiled eggs on toast. Alexa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm still feeling those delicious eggs in my tummy at the moment.
Nice. Okay, so we first connected through social media last year. We were sharing our birth stories and marvelled that not only are we both New Zealanders, but our daughters were born 12 hours apart on literally opposite sides of the planet, outside, beneath an oak tree, at night, in the water, with just their fathers there to witness their births. But before we get into the utter magicalness of Matea's birth, could you tell us how you came to be living in a yurt?
Yes, I can tell you all about that. So when I was young, I gathered a passion for travel, and I spent 5 years of my life, from when I was about 22 to about 27, just traveling around the world, following my heart, following the summer, living outside. We traveled by bicycle for 6 months. I had this beautiful love of the world, which led me just to travel to all these different places and fall in love with all of these different people and cultures. And it led me to a country called Cyprus. And in Cyprus, that was the end of our 6-month bicycle trip. When we were a bit tired of biking, we decided that we'd like to live communally for a while. with the people who were on the bicycle trip. So we settled down in Cyprus, and we went, got invited to go and visit some people one day, and they had a yurt. And the minute I stepped inside that yurt, I thought, this is where I want to live. I've got to live in a yurt. It just felt fabulous. The round space, the feeling of coziness, the warmth, I think living within canvas and wood, you can still hear the outside. You're not cut off from that, like in a square house with thick walls. You can't hear the outside. And going in that yurt and still being able to hear the river outside and hear the birds, and it felt like being just a bit closer to nature, but still warm and cozy. So from the minute I went in that yurt, I thought, yes, that's where I want to live. So soon after that, I returned to New Zealand, and I looked up in the Woofing book. Woofing is willing workers on organic farms, so you can sort of go and offer your help around different farms in New Zealand. I know you know that. around the world, actually. And in that Woofing book was a couple called Jane and James who live down in the Banks Peninsula, and they have an eco stay with many beautiful yurts that you can go and stay in for the night. And so I contacted them and I said, I really want to come and learn how to build a yurt. So we went there, and over the next 6 months we woofed for them. So we're helping them to build a yurt of theirs, and in our spare time we were building our own yurt. So it took about 6 months, kind of part-time, like 2 to 5 hours working on it every day, as we built our own yurt. It's 6 meters diameter, made from wood, from the neighboring farm's tree and canvas, and then it's got an insulation layer and a beautiful eucalyptus floor. So we spent that time down there building it. And then, of course, we were wondering where do we want to live and what do we want to look for, and as a home space and a home area. And we'd done a permaculture course prior to that, and we met some beautiful, beautiful people. And one of the teachers on the course was Justin. He had some land, so we ended up going and moving our yurt and our life to Nelson, to the top of the South Island in New Zealand. And with that space, with that cozy, warm, round womb space of our yurt, and with my energy now not on travelling and moving or building the yurt, came just more time and more space for crafting and creating. And so my energy started to go into that, and I started needle felting. So that needle felting is the art of which how I make the fairy. So I make little fairies from wool and wire and use a little needle to poke it, and that's how you make these little fairies. So I bumped into some little girls, 8-year-old girls, on their school holiday, and they were making little animals, and they said, oh, come in, and invited me in, and they started to teach me how to do it. So I made a little owl, and from that moment I was just totally in love with this craft, because you can make pretty much whatever you imagine. So I went home that night and I started dreaming fairies. They just kept coming to me, dreaming. They would pop through, and I just thought, I have to make these. So I just started making. And because of being in the yurt and on that land, and before my life had been very much following the summer, because I love the sun and I love being warm and I love the energy of summer, being outside and alive. But then I just felt after all that time I needed all these winters of coziness and insideness, and so thus the fairies were born. And that's how so that's starting from living in this cozy yurt and building it and making my own income. And I just want to say one thing too, that something really important for me growing up was that I do everything myself. I think that's empowerment from my mum and my father, who really supported every step of my path to be really independent and really yeah, do everything myself. Like, I remember having birthdays when we were young, and I'd have to, I would make all the invitations, and then I would invent all the party games, and I would go and shop for the things that I needed, and then we would make our own party hat and everything. Like, everything in our family was really do-it-yourself. So I think that that ethic, or that quality, or that my parents gave me, it came into my adulthood, which is when I want to make sure I'm kind of kind of in control, or doing everything myself. So building my own house, making my own income with fairies from the market that I sell at the market, and then that led on to birthing myself as well, and to wanting to birth independently and feeling empowered in that birth.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's such a sustainable sort of way as well that your parents have helped you to grow up.
Definitely, yeah. So even now I live on a farm. It's kind of a farm. It's like a small homestead. There's a few cows, some chickens, some turkeys, just a couple of dogs. Like a really basic homestead, really. We're with two other families, and we grow a lot of our own food. There's a lot of fruit trees. We share food together sometimes. It's very relaxed in terms of communal living. There's no set rules or set meeting times or anything like that. It's very fluid and flowing, which works for all of us at the moment.
Excellent, yeah.
But all with that focus of kind of land care and people care, looking after each other and helping each other out, and living on the land, self-sustaining.
How did you find the land and the people? How did you all decide, oh, we all want to live on this land together?
So two of the people that we live with two other families, and two of the people we met through doing this permaculture course, and we just really connected, but that was before we had the yurt. So, and they were on a different land, but anyway, we really connected and wanted to live together. So at one point they invited us to go and live where they were living. So we did. So we've lived with that other family for the last 4 or 5 years, I think.
Oh, wow.
5 years, maybe. They're really beautiful. They really are family. And then the other family, so it wasn't super working on the other land where we were living. It just wasn't quite what we dreamed of. And so we did a beautiful ceremony, actually. It was an autumn, like coming into winter ceremony, where we wrote down first all of our fears about anything, just writing, getting them all out. Then we wrote about all of the things that we're grateful for in life. And then we were in the space to envision our future. So we wrote down all of the things that we wanted to call in for the future. And we planted them in the ground under some bulbs that would bloom in the spring. So the intention was that we set this vision into the ground and let it kind of, with our spirit and our minds, to let it develop over time. And then, oddly enough, or magically enough, as soon as those bulbs started to flower, we had contact. A random friend, a woman that we know a little bit from working with her in the past, and then the woman where we live now, she knows her as well. So she kind of connected us. She knew that we were looking for land, and the family where we live now, Brooke and Aaron, they were kind of open to having people live on their land. So she said, hey guys, why don't you meet? And we met, and we just all got along so well immediately. It just felt like, yep, this is the right thing to do. So we moved over, and that was a year ago. So we've been living together for the last year and a bit. And that's straight away when we moved here is when I conceived Matea.
Oh, wow.
So it was kind of, yeah, so I'd been dreaming of being a mum for a long, long time. And then as soon as we moved, it was like she knew that this is where she needed to come as well. It felt like she was waiting for us to move lands, to move into something that was better for us, whereas the other one wasn't quite. Yeah, it was quite incredible.
You were just talking about conceiving Matea, right?
Yeah. and that it brought me to the land, really.
Yes, yeah. Because you were talking about we were living in Cyprus and we were building the yurt. Was this all with Benji?
Yeah.
It was our connection to New Zealand and our daughter's birth stories that brought us together. So tell us about that journey for you. What led you to the decision to free birth, and what was your pregnancy like and the birth itself?
Cool. So I guess I'm all about empowerment. That's like one of my main missions in life, really, this kind of do it myself and being empowered in that independence.
Mm-hmm.
And so end of the first trimester, I went on an adventure to the North Island, teaching people how to make the ferry.
Mm.
So I was travelling around in the van and checking in there, and I bumped into an old school friend, and she told me about this podcast, and I downloaded it straight away. It's called Taking Back Birth.
Yeah,
that totally rocked my world. I just started listening, and the more I listened, the more I discovered that I feel like hospital is kind of the default option that's given to people as where to birth. It's seen as the safe place to birth by many people. But the more and more I researched and understood is that birth is the deep, deep trance, and that birth and labour that you need to go into, that you need to totally, totally surrender and trust your body, trust that your body and your baby know what they're doing. Birth works. This is what we've done. This is why we all exist. Because it works. I don't think that our bodies are flawed. And so the more and more I listened, the more I understood that what I needed to do for birth was to go and to be in that deep trance and to really surrender and really, really trust my body. And for me, that was the safest option to give birth. It wasn't to be there where I would be disturbed by bright lights or by sound or by being monitored or being any kind of checking, any kind of intervention. I didn't want it. I really didn't want it. And alongside that came this really strong feeling. So I'm a Taurus, astrologically I'm a Taurus. So Tauruses like to be comfortable and warm and kind of cozy, etc. And so through my pregnancy, I started getting this really strong vision that I was going to birth outside. And it was really bizarre for me because I know my own nature, which is that I would like to be inside by the fire, be really soft and cozy and comfortable. I imagine with my practical, rational brain is that's what would be the most ideal setting for me for birth. But it was like that vision came from this baby, Nicola, that she wanted to come outside. And so things just started to place that to happen. Benji started to build a hot tub that's heated by the fire. So we've got solar power, but we don't have enough that would heat water, because water takes a lot of power if you do it through electricity. So we decided to build this fire-heated hot tub. So that's what's outside under our big oak tree. And we did a couple of practice runs to warm it up and see how long it takes. And it took a long time. It can take between 7 and 12 hours or something like that for it to actually get hot.
Hmm.
So that means constant monitoring. So there was a little bit of apprehension too that if that didn't get heated in time or anything like that. Anyway, so I guess I really followed my intuition. And I didn't know, before I was pregnant, because I am such a logical and practical person, I didn't really... I mean, sometimes I have a feeling about something and I can just act on that feeling. But sometimes my practical brain or rational brain gets in the way and I try to logically make a choice. But for me, pregnancy and the birth was really about connecting with my intuition, really following what felt right rather than what might have looked right with my head, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I saw a midwife during my pregnancy. She's a really beautiful woman, and she's amazing. But the thing is, with a midwife in New Zealand, because they are paid by the government and by the health system, they need to fit into the law with regards to birth and labour and monitoring and checking and stuff like that. So her
kind of obligation. So it's the suggested obligation in the middle three handbook is that she should monitor me every 30 minutes. And because I'd chosen through the pregnancy, I read a lot about ultrasounds, and I decided that that wasn't the right choice for me. I could see more harm than good that was coming. As I said, I was connecting with my baby and with my body, and I felt like, I know I'm growing a baby in there. I can feel her. I can feel her moving. I just trusted her, and I felt like everything was right. I can't, logical brain can't really put a finger on it, but the feeling was right. The pregnancy felt like it was supposed to. I was well, I was healthy, I didn't feel like I needed.
Yeah, sorry.
I've got mad baby brain. My brain is very fuzzy since I'm a little babe. I guess fair enough, because all of my energy goes on her.
Yeah.
And it's not going my brain. Anyway, so I did see a midwife throughout the pregnancy, but I chose never to use electronic monitoring because knowing that I didn't want to. From what I heard about ultrasounds, is that ultrasounds give a very intense loud noise. Apparently, it sounds like an aeroplane taking off if you were wearing earmuffs. So, really intense sound. The same technology as the ultrasound is used for blasting apart cancerous cells. So I was thinking about what that might do to a baby or what effect that might have.
Right.
Lots of things led me to choose not to do an ultrasound. So with her, when I was thinking about the birth, with the legal obligation, she should monitor me every half an hour. That would have had to be with the Doppler, with the stethoscope, the metal one that you put your ear to the belly.
Oh, right, kind of like a Pinard horn, I think it's called.
That's right. Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
You got it. So she would have had to use that to monitor me. So imagine I'm in labour and I'm in the deep pool and I'm in the throes of feeling the surges, and then I have to somehow haul my body, my huge, big, round, pregnant body out so that she can use that with her ear right down by my vagina.
Yeah, no thanks.
No, thank you. I did find out afterwards that actually, of course, I'm in control, and I could have said to her that I didn't want that, any monitoring at all, mm-hmm. but I kind of understood that what needed to happen was even monitoring every half an hour. And I didn't want that.
Oh, okay, yeah. No.
Yeah. So what I wanted a free birth for a long time. Benji was a little bit more apprehensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's our first baby. It's just because it's all new. You don't quite know. I didn't quite know what I was going to feel or what it was going to be like or how I was going to manage it or, what it was supposed to feel like. But when the surges started to come, everything felt right. There was no doubt in my mind that everything was fine. So we kind of had this quiet agreement that if everything felt right, we wouldn't call midwife.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of how we got around the feeling of, okay, we could still call her if we needed. We felt that we needed this because it was the first time and not knowing what to do, but really wanting to be understood, to have a real understood birth without being bothered or just really letting my body do what it wanted to do. And so that's how it was. The labour began at 1:30 in the morning, just by kind of a strong surge, and I woke up to that quite excited and surprised. It was 2 days after my due date. I mean, I don't believe in due dates. Baby's coming when they wish. So she came 2 days after the prediction. Anyway, the surgery started to come in the night, and it was quite exciting. I sort of woke up and was like, oh, I think that might be happening, but let's just lie for a while and see, because they might go away again. Because that can quite often happen with labour, that they start and then they go away again. It's sort of the uterus just does practice runs sometimes. Yeah. About to do a big mission. So it does a little practicing. So So I thought, I'll just wait and see if it's practicing or if it's the real thing. And they continued.
Mm-hmm.
So we got up by about 4 or 5 in the morning. We got up and we made a big soup and we tidied the yurt and we kind of had gathered all these towels and tarpaulin just to have on the floor inside if it ends up happening inside. We braided to the yurt in the middle, it's got a big crown. And what a position that really had resonated with me from what I'd been reading was having braided red cord hanging over the yurt crown. So it was in the middle of the yurt and two ropes hanging down.
Wait, so what do you mean by a crown in the centre?
So a yurt is like, it's round. I mean, in the middle on the roof, there's a round wooden piece. And that the name of that's the crown.
Yeah.
So that's what we hung the rope over. So it was kind of smack dang in the middle of the yurt.
Mm-hmm.
With this red rope coming down that I could hold on to. Because, yeah, that sort of position really resonated with me of crouching and pulling and using gravity to support the contractions or surges. I believe, too, that using your body is really, using gravity is really important. I don't believe in sifting down or, I mean, well, of course, the most I believe it is following what your body says. But
yeah.
For what made sense to me was standing up and letting gravity support my baby to come down. So I stood for a long time holding those ropes,
mm-hmm.
and kind of rocking and swaying and holding my hips, making a lot of opening kind of noises. That day, we also went for a walk around the land. It was really beautiful, actually, because we had, it was October the 15th in New Zealand that spring, so it seemed like the perfect time to give birth. There were little chickens running around and little baby turkeys and calves and there were lambs across the road. Like every baby animal was kind of there with me.
Nice.
It felt like this amazing connection with the wider picture of I'm birthing right now.
Yeah,
I'm bringing also. Yeah, it just felt like exactly the right time to give birth.
In spring.
And so I was kind of walking around the land and just crouching in the grass when the third came and just enjoying having that contact with the earth and also knowing that this is what we do. This is what animals do. It's what people do. It's what my body's meant to do. I always believe that my body's meant to birth. It's, I'm a woman. It's what it's for. In a way, it's got the...
Yeah.
So I had a beautiful mother blessing that was a couple of weeks before the birth, and lots of the beautiful women came and they offered me some affirmation cards and they said things like my body and my baby know what to do, or every surge brings me closer to my baby. And somehow being in that deep trance of labor, sometimes in my subconscious these things would come through. It was very amazing. It felt just like the right words were coming, kind of through my subconscious. They were coming through and telling me now, okay, pay attention to that thing now. And that same subconscious reminded me to move when I needed to move, or stay still, or to change into a certain position, or even actually when to hop into the hot tub. I knew that it was important to wait until a certain moment that my body wouldn't just relax and slow down, but that it would support my body rather than stopping it.
Mm.
So by about 5 p.m. it felt like, yep, this is time to go in. It was the surges getting more and more intense. But the thing, you know, the whole time during my labor, there was no energy in my body. There's no blocking energy or stopping energy. At every moment, I was saying yes, 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 yes. I think that's the most thing that I said when I was in labor. I was just going, yes, and really welcoming each sensation, really experiencing them and feeling them and being with them. So I didn't really experience them as pain. It just felt like sensation in my body that I was totally welcoming. I was about to meet my baby, one of the loves of my life. So everything felt wonderful and perfect and like... It just felt all like it was meant to be. Yeah, it wasn't pain. It just felt right and good.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was really, it was so powerful. And I was also saying to myself, just relax, 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 and open and open and open. Just kind of like speaking a lot out to myself, out loud. just telling myself. And I truly loved it. Mm-hmm. It just felt like this beautiful journey of being so deep in something that's so unfamiliar and just having to totally surrender to what was. And just being with it and being in it. And it was heavenly. And it's quite funny because we've got sometimes when I tell this story and it say we didn't have a midwife or any medical professional, people say, oh, didn't you have enough time to call her? And actually, we did. We had a photographer there, so because I knew that it was going to be really deep in this trust,
yeah.
And I was so passionate about birth. I spent hours and hours reading about it and researching about it.
Of course, yeah.
So I know all the things to do if something happens. I know what to do. I'll tell you more about that. But I know what to do if something did happen. I didn't go into that naively. I researched it thoroughly. I didn't just make this random choice. I'm just going to have responsibility. It was a really strongly educated choice. I knew what I was doing, and that was really important.
Oh, yeah.
Because sometimes people say, oh, yeah, you didn't have enough time to call the midwife. And, well, we had plenty of time because we called the photographer. So she came and we got these beautiful pictures of this really special moment and the video, actually.
Too. Oh, cool.
Because yeah. Because I'm so birth passionate and I knew I wanted to just be in it, but I still want to know what it was like from the outside perspective. So I wanted her to be there so she could follow.
Yeah.
I could see that afterwards, really. And she didn't actually know that we had that agreement. We'd only talked a couple of times. And she did mention it a couple of times in the labour, like, oh, we could probably call her now, if you like. But I just sort of said no. And then she asked me a couple of times too, should we call her now? And I just said, no, I'm fine. It felt good and it felt right and I really trusted that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably good she didn't know that was our plan because she was very relaxed. She was amazing. She was just sitting off to the side. And sometimes I'd sort of open my eyes and look up and she'd just be there eating her avocado or reading a book. Or she was just perfect person to have there because she totally wasn't interfering, wasn't intervening. And I told her that I didn't want anything. I don't want anyone to tell me to change position or la 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 la. I just want to be in it.
Yeah.
She knew that. So she just, yeah, it was really amazing.
Yeah, that's brilliant. But she wasn't stressful, like stressed about it either. Yeah.
Yeah. And because the other thing is that she was watching me, not that I was totally aware, but she was observing me and seeing how calm I was. Like, the entire labor, all you hear from me was like, yes, like that was my labour, that was what I was saying, that was what was verbally coming out. So she couldn't believe that I would be so far along.
Right, yeah.
So at one point I started to fall asleep in between the contractions.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sort of like just dozing and sometimes Benji would need to sort of prop me up. So Benji was amazing during the birth. He was drumming, so we'd read a lot about shamanic drumming.
Mm-hmm.
With that steady rhythmic drumming allowed you also, if I had been in my rational brain, to just go into feeling and go into experiencing rather than thinking. So his drumming was really amazing and he was chanting and he was just being present with me. I didn't need a lot from him except holding my hands sometimes. I'm quite a touchy person, so I imagined that I'd want massage and strong touch and things like that. But I didn't actually need much at all. I just needed him to hold my hands, which is kind of grounding for me.
So was it quite therapeutic then, listening to him drumming?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. It was amazing. It just added to the whole trance of it. It allowed me to go deeper and deeper and be in it. And sometimes we'd be chanting or we would sing together. Or at one point I was singing one of my favourite songs, which was, life, dancing at your feet, life, to the great mystery, life, we celebrate everything. And just again and again and again, because yes, it just was right and good, and it felt just amazing.
That's so beautiful,
It was glorious. It was truly one of the most glorious days of my life. Wow. So then I started to fall asleep between a contraction. And kind of somewhere in my subconscious, I know that in transition, there's a time where it feels like it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of got a little bit to that point. I was like, ooh, at one point I was like, oh, okay, this is quite intense. And then, of course, my subconscious came through and said, okay, you're going in transition now.
Yeah.
This is it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the time when your baby's about to come. But then I keep falling asleep. I was falling asleep, and then I'd wake up and have a surge, and then I'd fall asleep again, and then I'd wake up for that surge, and then fall asleep again. And it was very, when looking back on that I was allowed, because of course it was just me, I was in control really. Nobody was telling. I've heard other stories of medical professionals at that point making the woman get up and walk around so the labor keeps going, etc. And because it was just me at home, my body was doing what it needed to do, and at that time it needed to sleep and it needed to rest. And that's actually quite a common thing in transition, so that you have a little nap.
Yeah.
So I was transitioning, and then at one point I started to feel my body pushing. And that's amazing, because when you listen or watch birth on TV, it's this big drama of push! Push! Like, this is what you have to do. You have to push your baby out. But actually, my body just started to push itself. And that's the thing. It's called the fetal ejection reflex.
Mm-hmm.
And so at one point, I woke up to one of those surges and felt my body start to push. And I'm like, this is incredible. There's no part of me, conscious me, pushing. And it was entirely my body. My body just started to do it. And all I had to do in that moment was totally surrender. And that was a hard part, because the rest of the time I'd be so conscious of being like, yes, yes, open, open. But at that moment, I had to totally surrender, because my body was totally doing what it needed to do. And I just had to let it. And that was probably one of the most intense parts, was just letting it do what it did. I felt like every fiber of my being pushing with all of its might, and then I realized, wow, this is actually my baby's actually coming now. And at one point I reached down and I could feel the top of your little head. It just blew me away. That was the most glorious moment, to just reach down and feel this tiny patch of hair, and knowing that this little being was about to come out.
Wow.
It was just amazing. And then I could feel that kind of get bigger and bigger. I forgot to tell you that just before that, because I'd been so relaxed and falling asleep, Talitha, the photographer, she'd actually gone inside to go to sleep because she thought, oh, I must be so far off. I must be like hours away, because I was just far too relaxed and chilled out. She couldn't believe that a baby would be anywhere near, so she went to bed. And then about 10 minutes later, I called her. I was like, come, she's coming, the baby's coming. And that's when my body started to push. So she came back out and started to video and take photos for it. Very unobtrusive, so I had no idea she was doing. So, I felt this patch of hair, and it was just amazing. What a moment to touch this little being who's kind of between worlds. Between being inside you and coming out, it was fascinating. And then started, so her head started to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened about 3 times, actually. It was like she was a bit apprehensive about coming, because she would kind of come and then she'd go back, and she'd come and then she'd go back. And each time Benji was watching me, he said it was like I was in deep dialogue with her. I was really talking to her and saying, come, baby, we're ready to be your parents. We're ready for you to be here. You just need to make the choice to come out now. We're ready. And I was just telling her, come, like, it's your time to be here. And just really deeply in this deep dialogue with her as she was coming through. And on the fourth time of her head coming, her honk head came out. And that burned. That was the first time in the whole thing that I swore, and I said, stop, that hurts. It's one of funny moments because you just sound so relaxed. And suddenly I'm like, fuck, that hurts. Because I was just feeling, felt like a burn. But again, it's so worth it because I know her head was there. And I knew straight away. So I reached down and I checked for the cord around her neck. So that's something that I've read about it. Yeah, maybe it can be around the neck a few times and it can be dangerous. So I felt like it was important to check straight away. So I did. And I discovered that she did have the cord around her neck. So something you can do for that is just use your finger and hook it around her head while she's still there, just her head out. Mm-hmm. And I tried that, but it was really tight. So I had the feeling that she needed to come out right then. I didn't want to, at that point, wait for the next surge. I wanted to have her out right then because I didn't know how tight it was or how that was feeling for her. So I felt like, okay, no, I'm getting her out now. So on the next second, I pushed her out. Her whole body came out into the water. Just before that, Benji started to sing. It was quite amazing. He just started to sing to welcome her. It was bizarre. He started this beautiful song. And then she came out into the water. And I whispered her cords around the neck. And I was just unwrapping it from around her neck so easily. And then I was slowly bringing her up to the surface of the water. And she opened her eyes and she was looking up at us from underwater. It was, again, the most surreal experience forever. I will never forget that moment of this little being just looking with his big, deep blue eyes, just looking up at us, ready to come out of it. So she came up, so when you have the water, but we lift the back of the head up first so that the liquid is draining out from the nose and the mouth down.
Mm-hmm.
So I lifted her up like that and put her on my shoulder, and it was so, 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 so amazing. So to finally hold this little being. And the pool had been total hot the whole time, warm and warm, just perfect for the pain. And at the exact moment she came, it was just body temperature. It was perfect. It was what it was supposed to be for a baby to come. It was incredible. Wow. Every single moment of it was so perfect. But of course, soon after it was a cold night, so we straight away went for a few glorious moments of loving her. We climbed out of the pool and went inside, and Talitha had made a fire in there because when she went to sleep, so that was perfect as well. So we straight away go somewhere warm and be with her, and then we realised actually that she was struggling to breathe a bit. And when I looked back, at no point did I panic about that because, in my opinion, she was still connected to the placenta. So the placenta has been her organs, her extra body that has allowed her to function for the last 9 months. So she still had that attached. So in my opinion, she didn't need to breathe air just like that straight away. She still had what she needed.
Had you birthed the placenta yet?
No, sorry, the placenta was still inside me.
Right, yeah. And had she been crying or anything? Had she, been breathing up in that point?
She did a little mew, like a little cat. I still call her a little cat sometimes because she's got some little cat-like qualities. She's got a nickname called Porshka. So she came and sounded like, oh, kind of a very soft little cry, and it's still her voice is very soft and sweet.
Okay.
And she was breathing. You could just hear a bit of, just a bit husky, like a bit wheezy.
Right, yeah.
So you could hear, it wasn't like a human, an adult breath, it wasn't clear, like ours. So she was took a little while for her to breathe, as we breathe.
Yeah.
So she was inside, and at that point we thought, oh, we just check in with the midwife. But I wasn't panicking, I felt like, it felt right, the whole thing felt really right. It felt like she might have needed a little bit of support to breathe. So Benji was giving some little puffs over her mouth and nose, little puffs of air, to just support that and help the little capillaries of the lungs to fully open up and start working. And we just called them and went in, and she came, and yeah, and everything. We were in love.
Oh, congratulations. Well done.
Yeah, I still look back sometimes from that, the birth of the videos and the photos, and just really reconnect with the power that I felt at that time.
Yeah.
I got a few years ago, 3 years ago, I got diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and it just made me a little bit knocked off my confidence. I haven't quite been me for a little while before that. And when I had that birth, me came back. I came back. I am now fully empowered in who I am. I needed that birth and that experience to
become yourself again.
Yeah, fully be me again. Yeah, to give me the power back.
Wow, that's really nice. So, how did it all go at the start? Like, how was breastfeeding?
So, it was because she took a little while to start to breathe properly. A lot of the focus was on that. And then it was on getting placenta out. Yeah, when the midwife came, she felt like she needed to get that out quickly. So I was under a bit of pressure to get, that was my least favourite part of the birth, was trying to breathe the placenta with under that pressure. And yeah, that didn't feel very good. Anyway, so a lot of focus was on that. Yeah, a lot of focus was on that. So breastfeeding was, that was harder than I thought. After having that very empowered birth, suddenly to, I thought you'd sort of just pop the baby on your boob and off you go, and it's definitely like that for some women, and it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
It was much harder than I thought, getting the angle right, the timing right, position right, everything. She wasn't super interested or super keen. It seemed like she'd just rather have her placenta back to eat. She just wasn't, she wasn't so good. So it was a bit hard for me. And I did end up with mastitis in the beginning.
Right, yeah.
For a couple of weeks. So that got quite bad. So I thought I'd got onto it. I believe in natural healing. And so I've got some people that I've talked to about how to naturally heal. And what I discovered with mastitis is a lot of high-dose vitamin C, a lot of different essential oils, massage, lecithin. There's a lot of things you can do pre-antibiotics, and I really didn't want to have antibiotics, especially on, well, on my tummy, my body. I don't like them. I don't like what they do.
Yeah.
And so I tried my best to heal it naturally. And my symptoms went away quite quickly. So I wasn't having fever anymore, that'll calm down. So I thought, oh, great, I've come out of it. But actually what had happened is it had turned into an abscess. So that as soon as the swelling went down, I discovered a big lump, which I hadn't been able to feel before. And there was an hospital, which was quite, that was quite a bummer after having this really wild, glorious free birth. Having to go into the hospital, but also feeling filled with gratitude that's a different option for support when you need it.
Oh, yeah.
And they were beautiful. The maternity ward, they were amazing. They gave full care, and they were beautiful. And they were also very inspired to hear my story, actually. They'd all sort of heard rumours of this womanhood's free birth because it wasn't common for them to hear about. So they were really interested to hear how it went and what it was like, and very happy and inspired by the story. So perhaps that was why that happened.
Yeah. So how, at what point was this? Like, how old was your daughter at this point?
She was 2 weeks old, I think, 2 or 3 weeks.
Oh, okay. Yeah. What would you do differently next time then to try and avoid that?
For that? Yeah, so I've had it come back a couple of times since then. First, hop straight into bed. So there's the first thing is empty breast, lots of breast. So hop into bed and make sure baby's feeding off that side, off the sore side of the infected side. You can kind of pump the other side to make sure that your flow doesn't go down too much, or let her feed off it a little bit. High dose vitamin C rocks. That is the immediate thing I do if any illness is coming. I take a lot of that. That just really kicks it. Lecithin, that really helps because it thins out the milk, so it allows it not to be blocked. some sort of massage with lavender essential oils. I think those are probably my main aromatic probiotics too. Just a lot of like supporting my immune system, supporting my body to fight with itself. I think that's my mission with healing my body. Go for, you know, focusing on supporting it to get it stronger.
Yeah. I thought I had done well keeping my daughter totally naked and skin to skin and diaper free for the first 10 days of her life. But after 10 days, I was finding diaper free nights too challenging because I didn't mind the extra washing the next day, but she didn't seem to like being moved over a potty in the night. And when we had a miss, since she was sleeping cuddled into my side, I would also get partly wet, which was okay while it was warm, but when it cooled down it was pretty uncomfortable, so I didn't sleep very well. Since then I reluctantly put her in a diaper at night time, but so I was beyond impressed that you have successfully continued with this. How have you made it work? Can you talk about this?
Yes. So, it's so funny because I had a son with spring baby, so it's much easier. I was thinking about that. With nappy free, it's certainly a lot easier when you've got a baby in the warm time of the year. So for the first 6 weeks of her life, both me and her were naked.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So if anyone would come over, we just had no clothes on. And that's okay. That the people who were coming were close friends. And if they weren't comfortable, then fair enough, they could go again.
Yeah.
So we actually stayed in the yurt really for the first month just together.
Mm-hmm.
And we're naked. So being naked is very easy to observe her cues, observe what the signs that she makes before she's about to pee. So it was really easy to get to know her signs. So most of the time we'd have her lying on a cloth nappy. So we'd be able to see what happened before and then see the result of the pee as if we were able to start offering her the potty. Actually, we did it just the day after she was born because a very common time babies pee is right on when they wake up. So as soon as they wake up, you offer them a pee and you're pretty much guaranteed to catch one. So it's a beautiful place to start, really. It's a rewarding place to start.
Yeah.
In the night, it's funny that you say that about diapers in the night, because I started with her with a nappy on in the night, the first two nights. And then they were always wet, and I didn't want her to be in wet too long. So I didn't have to change the nappy in the night. And I found that more complicated than just having her lying on a nappy, on a cloth nappy. So what we've got at the moment is a cloth, an organic cotton pad, it's waterproof. I had a few of them. On top of that, she would lie on a cloth nappy. So she would sleep on her back. If she peed, it would just be straight underneath her. So what would happen is if I missed her cue to pee and she peed on the nappy, I could just chuck it out to bed and then put another dry one underneath. I found that easier than changing a whole nappy under all the buttons and stones or whatever you've got. And what I noticed is that actually she wiggles a lot before she pees, so I'll be lying beside her and my sleep starts to be a little bit disjointed because I can feel this little wriggling body. We sleep together, which is right beside me. And I just start to feel a wriggling, and then I know, oh, that means she needs to pee. And nowadays, the only time I miss it is when I'm too tired to wake up in time to offer her. But mostly, it's just what we do. She wriggles, I pick her up, offer the potty, which is beside the bed, and she pees. Leave her again and we both go back to sleep. So like last night I didn't miss any, which was amazing.
Well done.
Yeah. it's a big win in our house if that happens. I was
impressed
how good my night was by how many nappies we used. How many I missed or didn't miss, and the worst was seven misses, so seven times 15, seven nappies. And then the best was last night, there was none, I didn't miss any. Because I just wasn't, it really depends on how tired I am. If I'm not too tired and I tell myself before I go to sleep, and she wriggles, get up and offer her a pee.
Yeah.
So it's really dependent on me. I know her fear, it's just me needing to get up and offer.
Yeah.
And it's been a very long time since we've had a three Nippy.
Yeah, yeah.
Which it's quite bizarre when it does happen because it's so uncommon. I don't know how people manage it all the time.
I know.
And I love it. I really love the first connection with them as I was listening to this. To be able to really meet every need she's got. At the moment, she gets a little bit even frustrated to tell us, like, I'm trying to tell you I need to pee now. She'll be like, She often changes her breathing. Breathing goes faster. She'll go, we can see it if she's looking, we're looking at her, because previously she was engaged in whatever she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly she's looking all around the room, or she won't connect with you, she won't give you eye contact because she needs something, obviously. And I do the same actually when I need to pee. I can't be fully present with anybody. I'm busy.
Oh yeah, that's so true. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a different thing. There's lots of different ways, but I love meeting that need for her. I can't imagine not doing that
anymore. Yeah. That's really nice.
Yeah.
So what is it like living communally? What is it like to be raising Mateo while living communally? The families that you live with, do they help out? Are they in her life a lot?
They are. We see them every day. Either I go out walking with Mateo. She really loves other children. And there's two wee boys who live here, her 4 and 6, and they're such good friends. She goes crazy to see them. She'll chat, and I swear she says hi to them at the moment. She sees them and she says hi. She's so funny. She's starting to talk too. The other day I was holding her on my lap and I said, do you need to pee? And she goes, yeah, and peed on my lap. Very funny. but she loves them. She loves visiting those schools. In the beginning when I had a newborn, they would be cooking food for me and bringing it over, coming over and doing my dishes, and really, yeah, felt a lot of care. I think we're not ready to do that alone. You know, I just wasn't me in the first being a new mum. I mean, I felt like doing the dishes or cooking or whatever. It's harder than before. It's not just the ease of just doing it. And so having support from them has been really amazing. Sometimes they would take the cab for a walk or a nap. Or we had a sweet lunch the other day, so Brooke wore her in the ergo. We have a baby carrier, and she had the tail there so I could go in. It's pretty amazing. I think I can't imagine doing this another way as well. It's beautiful to have that care and that support right there with you.
Of course. And are they like-minded in the way that you're raising her?
It definitely. So Brooke and Andrew, the nappy free with their boys. So she's really good at reading the Mateo's signs. Actually, everybody is. Everybody loves to be a part of nappy free with her as well. So they're not just playing with her when they're with her. Everybody is really aware of her needs and what she might want and need, and if she needs to pee or not. And everybody rather delights in offering her the chance to pee or poo. And when they have success, it's very celebrated within everybody. That's quite beautiful.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're all very different, but we've all got a lot in common as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is a major misconception that you think people have about your lifestyle, in particular with reference to the wild way you are raising Matea?
I don't know if I know the answer to that, because I actually only feel like I get a lot of positive feedback. A lot of people.
Oh, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Many people are very surprised and very impressed with how I am with her and how I can meet the needs that she's got.
Well, that's just so wonderful to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. I haven't had much. Yeah. Not yet. I will have a think about that, though.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll go to the next question then.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you think could be changed to make raising wild children more widely practiced and socially acceptable?
Ooh. I guess knowledge I think that that might be something that's harder to come across. Like, people are always so surprised when they hear that we do nappy-free withdrawal, that she can pee on the potty. They're like, what? Mm. She's a baby. But it's just not something that they've heard of. So, of course, I like to find every opportunity I can to talk about it so people get that awareness and then know that it's not. You don't have to have let your baby learn to pee just in a nappy. You can, there is another way of meeting their needs, as do tribal societies. So I think perhaps a lack of knowledge. I think that's what I'd like to actually offer to the world, is some sharing about these different ways of doing and how it can easily fit into the way of life.
Yeah. I will put links to the social media pages for your business, Spooning Trees. Is there anywhere else for people to get in contact with you that I can share in the show notes?
I think that would be, yep, Spooning Trees is a good one.
Cool. Yeah, I can do that. Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Alexa, and sharing these experiences with us. Do you have any final words?
I guess it would be focus on the birth, that birth is yours. It can be just as you imagine it and just as you dream it and just as you wish it to be. You've got the power. You are the one birthing your baby, and you can let that happen as you need it to happen, as you want it to happen. Yeah, I think that about life in general, really. Everybody can do whatever they wish to do and however they wish to do it. Life is yours.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.